need to look into its history. And if you look into the oldest written history, you're forced to turn to the Old Testament. There we find the word diamond written three different times. First time it appears in the book of Exodus. There's a statement there to the effect that Aaron the high priest is to wear a breastplate on which there are precious stones representing each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And one of the precious stones is a diamond. Well, there's another reference in the Old Testament to diamond, used for its adornment, used because it's a thing of beauty. And then in Jeremiah, which was supposedly written about 700 years B.C., there's an industrial reference to diamond. For there it is recorded that the sins of Israel were to be written with a pen of iron and with a point on this pen of iron of diamond on the horns of the sacrificial altar. Well, to me, this indicates that men at a very early time knew that diamond was the hardest of all substances and consequently could be used to write on any other substance. Well, in our own day, diamond is still the hardest of all substances and can be used, therefore, to cut and polish and grind or mark all other substances. Now, these two uses for diamond, its use for engagement rings or other things of beauty, and its industrial use, are still today the primary uses for this material. It is thought that the early diamonds mentioned in the Bible came from India. The finds of diamond in India have pretty much run out. The diamonds were obtained along the banks of the Kishna River, and there men and boys would shovel gravel from the banks of this river and put the gravel in with their baskets, which the women and younger kids would take off to the side and pick out all the pebbles until they'd come to a diamond. Now, Tavernier, the man who first wrote about this, observed and estimated that they would pick out 60 million pebbles before they'd come to a tiny diamond. And I like to think that this is where the expression Slim Pickens originated. Now, the second source of diamonds, about which we know very much, was discovered about the time of the American Revolution in South America. Now, it's a very interesting history here. Just let me give you a tiny bit of it. There was a Portuguese fellow by the name of Fonseca Lobo who had headquarters for a mining office in the port of Goa, which, as you know, is on the Atlantic coast of India. This was a trading port in mining interests and diamonds. At that time, it was the world's diamond trading port. There was a gold rush on in Brazil. And this Fonseca Lobo decided to get on a sailing vessel and go to Brazil and see what this was all about. Well, first thing he noticed was that the miners there played cards every single night. Well, now maybe this is not too unusual for miners, but there was something unusual about the card playing. For counters in their various card games, they were using some bright, transparent pebbles. These pebbles were diamonds, but the miners didn't know it. And Fonseca Lobo, recognizing that these were diamonds and that the miners didn't know it, of course purchased them for a very small sum, all of them that they had. And he returned back to the port of Goa, a very rich man. Well, here's what had happened. As these miners were panning for gold in these gold fields, and you know, you're from Colorado, you ought to know about panning. You take a pike in, a large one, about this big, and you put it down the river gravels and sand and kind of sluice it around. And the minerals of high density, such things as gold, end up in the bottom of your pan. Well, diamonds are of high density, not nearly as high a density as gold, but much higher than the ordinary sand and silicate rock you'd find in a river gravel. So these pretty diamonds were turning up along with the gold to the miners. It was a pretty thing, and they decided using for counters in their card game. Well, pretty soon there was a diamond rush in Brazil, as well as a gold rush. A lot of interesting history here that I can't go into. Now, the most important source of diamonds, and the one which today remains the most important source, was not discovered until about 1890. This was really not too long ago. At this time in history, near the junction of two great rivers in South Africa, the Orange and the Vaal, land was being homesteaded by Dutch settlers who were called the Boers.
You've probably heard of the Boer War, especially if you read the funny paper and read about Major Hooper and the exploits he occasionally mentions of his in this Boer War. Well, at the junction of these rivers, there were many pretty river gathers, many pretty rocks, and it was just a real common sight to see these pretty rocks around the farmhouses, because the kids would pick them up, keep them like a kid would keep pretty marbles today. Well, one day a youngster came home with a water-white, transparent, shiny, glistening stone that he showed to his mother. His mother had never seen such a stone before. The incident was momentarily forgotten, but a little later in the afternoon, a neighbor by the name of Schalk van Eeker came over to talk to this Frau Jacobs, and during their conversation, she happened to mention this pretty stone. Said he'd like to see it. Well, it couldn't be found for a moment, but finally the youngster went out in the yard where he'd thrown it and picked it up. And after looking at it, Nico says, the father has some value, that's the bath family. The story goes, the Frau Jacobs just threw it for him and said, you can have it. This Schalk van Eeker had it taken 200 miles down the Orange River on a riverboat from the Atlantic Ocean, where it was then taken on a ship down to Cape Town, South Africa, where the nearest geologist was located. Geologist, whose name was Arthur Stone, appropriate name for a geologist, looked at this and said it was a diamond. Well, eventually this was sold for $5,500. Now, farming was kind of hard in this area, and if you could go down to the river with bottoms and pick up pretty stones and sell for $5,500, this looked like a good occupation. So the farmers left the work for a little while and went down and looked for diamonds. But not much was found. In fact, 10 months went by before any diamonds were found. At that time, a couple of tiny stones, not of much value, were located. Well, farmers went back to farming. They kind of knew about diamonds now, but not much was being found. But then one day, Schalk van Eeker saw one of the natives of the area with a tremendously large stone, and he just knew it was a diamond, so he struck up some kind of a bargain, trading off some cattle and sheep and cloth and brass and other things for this diamond. It turned out that this diamond weighed 87 1/2 carats, and it was nearly perfect. It was sold for $55,000. It was cut into several fragments, the largest of which is known to still be in existence. It's the Star of South Africa, and this is worth much more than $55,000 today. Well, this kind of set the stage for a real find, which was yet to come. Now, you've heard the expression, he's just a diamond in the rough. I assume that every cadet here is just a diamond in the rough. But, of course, with the proper polishing and cutting and whatever else has to be done, your inner beauty will be brought out. Well, this is true of diamonds. If you hadn't been trained or had any idea or notion in your head of the physical characteristics of a diamond that you could look at with your eye or feel with your hand, you'd pass these diamonds in the rough right up. You'd pass them right by along with the rest of the gravel. But these farmers in this area now had an idea of what a diamond was like, what it looked like. One day, a farmer whose name was Detroit went out to a patch of yellow clay on his farm. Now, patches of yellow clay in this vicinity were common. They were so common that they had a name for them. They called them pans. A shallow pan-like depression in the ground filled with a yellowish clay. He was digging some of this clay, putting it in a bucket, and over-troweling it into the cracks between the logs in his log cabin when the tip of his trowel struck a hard object, and he plucked it out and looked at it, and it was a diamond. This is the first recorded instance in which a diamond had been found in such a material as this yellow clay. It had always been found in river gravels before. Well, to make a long story short, geologists came in, looked this situation over. He had dug deeper, found more diamonds. There were 200 of these such pans approximately in this area. Geologists decided this pan represented what remained of an extinct volcano. Not a volcano such as we know today, an entirely different kind of volcano.
But at one time, this high plateau land had great mountains rising above it, and that the erosion that had taken place of rain and wind and snow through the ages had worn these volcanic cones down, and this was what was left. And the reason that diamonds were found in the Orange and the Vale River, and any other place they had been found in river gravel, was that they had been formed deep in the earth, probably, brought up by this volcanic action, and then the core of the volcano, of course, had been washed into the rivers and whatnot, and the diamonds would then be found there. Well, there's a lot of interesting history connected with this diamond find in South Africa. I don't have time to tell you about it. But the South African diamond fields remain today as the principal source of both gem and industrial diamonds. There is a diamond pipe, as they are now called, the remains of one of these shallow clay pan-like deposits in the United States. It's found in Pike County, Arkansas, and there are diamonds there, but they are in such low concentration they cannot be mined properly. There are extensive diamond fields in the Soviet Union, and there are a few other places in the world where these pipes are found. And then there are gravel beds and sands and beaches and whatnot that are worked in certain parts of the world where the diamonds are also found and mined today. Now, 80% of the diamonds that are mined are used industrially. But this 80% of the diamonds by weight that are used industrially represent only 20% of the value. The gem diamonds are of much higher value than the industrial diamonds. Diamond tries to crystallize in a naturally beautiful octahedral shape. I guess there's some chalk down here. Diamond tries to crystallize as an octahedron, an eight-sided perfect geometrical figure. But it rarely makes it. It's this diamond in the rough that I talked to you about. Even if it does crystallize this way, over the long era and period of geologic time, it's worn down in the rivers and by other processes may be broken and ruined so that it's irregular and rough. In the 14th century, diamonds became very popular in the French court. These beautiful natural octahedra were the things that were sought and prized for their beauty, but since there weren't enough of them, some smart Dutchman learned how to take these rough ones and grind them into that kind of a shape. Now, before I go any further on this grinding story, let me tell you about a very simple principle that's at work every day in industry that you may not have thought too much about. The principle is this. A tool that you use is always harder than the work, where it's possible to have a tool harder than the work. That's the only way you can get any efficiency and any kind of an operation that requires the use of a tool. For example, a carpenter who works with the material wood doesn't use a wooden saw to cut his wooden board. It's too slow. He uses a steel saw because the steel is harder than the wood and can effectively cut the wood without itself being worn away. Now then, if we look at a saw, however, it has teeth cut in it, holes drilled in it for a handle, it somehow has been rolled into a nice steel strip, and there must have been a tool used to make the saw that was harder than the saw. And then there must have been a tool that was harder than the tool that made the saw that's going to cut the board and make the cabinet. And of course, you see, this is kind of a chicken and egg proposition. Now, there are landmarks on this hardness scale of tools. There are steels of various hardness, and so on. Well, there is a landmark material known as cemented tungsten carbide that was invented by the Germans back in 1927, approximate date. This is much harder than the hardest of steels. It's a material that's becoming very common. Even if you have a home workshop with a power saw, you may have a saw in which there are tungsten carbide teeth. It's also used for drilling concrete. Well, nowadays industry would stop without tungsten carbide. It's used everywhere. Of course, you don't see this product in your washing machine or your radio, but if you go to the factory where they're made, you'll see this used in tools, jigs, dies, fixtures, everywhere. It's a heavy material. It's heavier than mercury, almost three times as heavy as steel for a given volume, and it's expensive material. Here is a cylinder of the stuff. It's valued at about $150. Now, this hard material somehow has to be finished to a shape. You'll notice that this has a nice cylindrical hole through the center. The exterior is a nice cylinder, and the ends have been cut off nice and square. There is only one substance that is hard enough to finish this, to be the tool that finishes the tungsten carbide, which again is used as a tool for working softer substances. And that material is diamond. And most of the diamond that is used in the world is used to finish tungsten carbide tools. Let me pass this around. If your cadets would only take about 20 seconds to look at it, I think you might get it around before the lecture's over, and perhaps you haven't seen such a substance. Now, the diamond tools take many forms. Here's an example of one of the very common forms that is used in finishing tungsten carbide. It's simply a grinding wheel. It's a relative of any grinding wheel you've seen for sharpening hoes or axes or scissors. It's composed of diamond grit embedded in some matrix, in this case, a plastic matrix. Now, you've seen the sharp silicon carbide or aluminum oxide grinding wheel. The entire wheel has the grain or the grit that does the work in it. But diamonds are so expensive, you can only put the grit in the rim of the wheel. So there's only a 1/16 inch thick rim around this little wheel in which tiny diamond grit that you can hardly see, it's so fine, is embedded. Now, I'm going to pass this wheel around, too. This wheel is worth $150, and most of that value is simply because of the diamonds around it. I have seen diamond wheels valued over $100,000 that are used in cutting large slabs of concrete. The use of diamonds is becoming so common that I read just last week that some 23 miles, I believe it was, of concrete was smoothed out by spinning diamond wheels down in Los Angeles here during the last year. It's getting so the automobiles travel so fast that you can't have a bump in your concrete greater than 1/8 of an inch if it's going to be a federally approved superhighway. And this was an old highway in which it settled here and settled there, and it got pretty bumpy. And so instead of tearing it up, they used diamonds, which are very effective since they're the hardest known substance at grinding concrete, and just ground the thing flat again. The center of this particular wheel is aluminum. Now, the diamonds are small in this wheel, but this is the common size of diamond that is used in grinding wheels. The most common size of all is known as 100 grit diamond. Turn it a little in the light, you can see a slight sparkle, and take your fingernail, and you can feel the diamonds scratching your finger, and give yourself a kind of an exotic diamond manicure. Approximately $25 million worth of diamond are consumed every year in the United States in this kind of a diamond grinding wheel. Now, I've got to get back to my story about this rough diamond situation. Now, I just told you that the common principle that's used in industry all the time is that the tool that you use is harder than the material that you're working. But if diamond is the hardest of all known substances, what in the dickens are you going to use to work the diamond? Well, the answer is diamond itself. It's all there is that you can use. And the problem is just as difficult as that carpenter building himself somehow a wooden saw to use to cut his wooden board. Well, what you do in the case of diamonds is to take a wheel, a spinning wheel, and I'm showing this in cross-section, spinning about this axis, made of cast iron. Cast iron surface is a little bit porous. And you take diamond powder and put it on this wheel, and then you hold your rough diamond against the wheel while the wheel spins for a week or two, and it takes this long, and then you can wear a tiny facet on the diamond. Now, at first, when this started, there may have been a kind of a rough portion in just one place on the diamond. And the Dutchman would just kind of smooth that off and change the shape of things a little bit, but restore it so it looked pretty. But nowadays, they can take a pretty rough diamond, and they cut 54 separate facets on it for the so-called brilliant cut diamond, which is so popular in engagement rings that every girl in America wants to achieve one time or another in her life. Well, I think maybe that's enough on the history of diamonds and this general kind of an idea. Now, let's talk about making diamonds. When I was back at the General Electric Company, just a short time before diamonds were finally made, there was an interesting cartoon that appeared in the Albany Sunday newspaper. It was a Donald Duck cartoon. And these three little nephews of Donald's, you know, they're always giving him such a bad time. They came in one day to Donald, and Donald was sitting in his easy chair reading the newspaper, and they said, "Uncle Donald, our science teacher, Mr. Tyler, sure is smart." And of course, Donald didn't pay attention, or at least he acted like he didn't pay attention, went on reading his newspaper. And the little kid said such things as this. He says that hot air is lighter than cold air, and it will rise. And he said this, and he said that, and Donald still didn't pay any attention, so he went on describing some of these things that Mr. Tyler had been telling him in science, in the science class. And then finally they said, "And Uncle Donald, Mr. Tyler says the diamonds are nothing but coal, and that if you could take coal and subject it to a high pressure and a high temperature, it would turn into a diamond." Well, Uncle Donald, he still acted like he didn't pay any attention, and the three little nephews walked out of the room, and then the final punchline picture showed Uncle Donald back in his shed there, and he had a vise, and he had a lump of coal in the vise, and he was twisting the handle of the vise in one hand and holding the blowtorch on the lump of coal with the other. Now, that struck us particularly at that time, because here we were at the General Electric Company trying to make diamonds, and this cartoon came out just a short while before it was accomplished. Let me tell you about the history of making diamonds. It goes a long ways back. Of course, we had some intimation here tonight about the various things that scientists have tried to make down through the ages. And of course, the chemists, in seeking the Philosopher's Stone and the universal cure for disease and this, that, and the other, were also trying to make diamonds a long time before there was enough science developed to even have the slightest notion as how you go about it. But the first scientific event that came that gave you some kind of indication that you might be able to make diamonds occurred just about 1790. You've heard of the great French chemist, Lavoisier. He took some diamonds and he burned them in pure oxygen, and he obtained carbon dioxide as a product. Well, this proved to him and shows to us that diamond is carbon in its chemical composition, and that's all it is. It's just carbon. Now, the soot in your chimney or the graphite in your so-called lead pencil is pretty much just carbon. The soot, the graphite, is worth just a few cents a pound. If you could turn it by some process into diamond, in its cheapest industrial form, it would be worth $6,000 a pound. Well, you see, here's a real incentive for trying to turn graphite into diamond. If you could turn it into gem quality diamonds of large size, it would be worth many millions of dollars a pound. Well, of course, in the science viewpoint, there's another incentive. Whenever you realize that there are polymorphic modifications of a substance, and all a polymorph is, you know, it's the same chemical composition, but different properties for some reason, and in Lavoisier's day, they didn't know the reason. Okay, that's the first event, the discovery that diamond was nothing but carbon.
Now, there were other events that had to take place before diamonds could really be made. And, of course, nowadays, any scientific achievement is always based on what may have gone years and years ago. But there are several things, and I'd like to point them out to you, that had to go on before diamonds could really be made. In addition to this first thing, there's the science of thermodynamics, which had to be born. The science of thermodynamics tells us how much energy there is in substances, how much energy there is in graphite compared to how much energy there is in diamond. Now, the science of thermodynamics did not have this information for carbon until the year 1930. I can't go into all the long history. But in 1930, two American chemists, Jessup and Rossini, who worked at the Bureau of Standards, were able to pretty well calculate the energy conditions for graphite and diamond. Now, I don't want to get into the things that are too technical here, but just let me give you a slight picture. Jessup and Rossini were able to, through their thermodynamics, make a plot of pressure and temperature with a line which divided, and a lot of this was speculation and extrapolation from some experimental data at very low pressures and temperatures. The divided diamond from graphite. And we're able to say then, definitely, for the first time, and mind you, this was only in 1930, not too long ago, that pressure certainly was required to make diamond out of graphite. The geologists had assumed this from looking at these mines in South Africa, but they had no proof of it. And in addition, they were able to give some pressure and temperature consideration, showing that as temperature increased, the pressure required to turn the graphite into diamond. This is the dividing line between the two phases. The higher the temperature, the higher the pressure. Now, also, a science which tells you what polymorphs really are had to be developed. And this was the science of X-ray diffraction. In 1920, the Braggs, who did a lot to develop the science and the art of X-ray diffraction, were able to show that the thing that distinguished the two polymorphs, graphite and diamond, from each other was the fact that the atoms were arranged differently inside. Now, again, the geologists were the first ones out in this field. Geologists, in studying the external forms of crystals, had presumed that on the basis of an atom theory, there must be an arrangement of atoms inside a crystal that corresponded to the external arrangement in some manner. With X-ray diffraction, the Braggs were able to shine the pencil of X-rays into the crystals, get a pattern out, and by the proper mathematical interpretation, learn that in diamond, carbon atoms were arranged in a tetrahedral relationship to each other. A central carbon atom, a carbon atom up here, and then carbon atoms down here like a three-legged milk stool. In graphite, however, the carbon atoms were arranged in hexagons, like a honeycomb, when you look down on a honeycomb, so that the atoms were primarily in sheets or planes, and then there was a fairly wide spacing between the planes of atoms. So not until 1920 did we know the inside atomic differences between the graphite and the diamond. Graphite and diamond are, of course, very different in their physical and chemical properties. Graphite is black, it's soft and unctuous. Of course, you can write with it. That's why it's used in lead pencils. It conducts electricity, has a density of about 2.25. Diamond, on the other hand, is definitely crystalline in its external appearance as well as being crystalline internally. Transparent, it does not conduct electricity, the hardest of all known substances, and has a high density, 3.5. Couldn't find two more different things, yet atomically they're both carbon.
Well, another science that had to come along was the science of reaction rates. If I'm going to turn the graphite into the diamond, how long is it going to take? Well, then you get into the science of reaction rates, you get into the phenomena of catalysis and other things. Okay, all these sciences have come along. Now, technology had to develop to a certain point, too. We know now that it's going to take pressure and probably high temperature to make diamond from graphite. Well, we're going to get a machine to get the pressure that's required. Now, let me try and give you an idea of the pressure that's required to make diamond. You all are familiar with air pressure in the tire of your automobile or your bicycle. You're aware that there's a pressure of 15 pounds per square inch at sea level. Of course, a lot less up here at Air Force Academy, higher elevation. But the kind of pressures that Jessup and Rossini thought might be needed to make diamond were the neighborhood of 400,000 PSI. And rate considerations and other considerations, which I do not have time to go into, indicated that you might need 1,500 degrees centigrade at the same time you had the pressure to make the graphite turn into diamond. Let's take an imaginary trip to Washington, D.C. and visit the Washington Monument. That's a shaft of granite or marble, I don't know which extends into the sky for a height of about 1/10 of a mile. If we could find some contractor that could lift this off from its concrete pad and then get down on her hands and knees and put her fingers under the base and say, okay, Joe, let her down, we would start to feel what would seem to be a rather tremendous pressure. But to get the kind of pressure that we need, the thought we might need to make diamonds, we'd have to start stacking Washington monuments. We'd stack them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, not enough. 100 of them, not enough. We'd have to stack probably about, we'd have to stack 1,000. Stack about 1,000 Washington monuments until they reached into the air for 100 miles. This is the altitude at which some of the astronauts are going around. That's how we'd have to get in their way up there before we could get this kind of a pressure in pounds per square inch at the bottom of that monument. And the only reason I give you this crude example, of course, this would never work. This is not the way to generate pressure, but I'm trying to give you a feeling. The marble couldn't stand the load. It would crumble under the weight of the monuments that were above it. But this is to give you an idea of the tremendous pressure that would be required, that was thought. Well, so is the technology that had to be developed. Almost every major company around the world has at one time or another, since about 1880, attempted to make diamonds. Most of the work has been very secret. Matter of fact, 12 years ago, if you would tell anybody you were trying to make diamonds, even if you'd tell your scientific friends you're trying to make diamonds, they'd say, oh, you're nuts. it has been shrouded in a crackpot kind of a thing. Anybody that's trying to make diamonds is a crackpot. Now, there was a lot of high-pressure I'm not going to review the history of various people's attempts to make diamond. I'm going to get right down to the General Electric attempts, which began in 1951. There were people who had developed quite a bit of high-pressure technology. There was one outstanding man, though, who shone above all the rest. His name was Percy W. Bridgman, professor at Harvard University, who in about 1948 obtained the Nobel Prize for his work at high pressure. This man had worked almost single-handedly in this field, the only one interested, from about 1905 through about 1945. He had a few papers after 45, but his whose primary interest span was those 40 years. While trying to build on what Bridgman had done, the GE people in 51 decided, the director of the lab in Schenectady, New York, vice president for research, Chauncey Dysart, decided that we'd give this thing a whirl and that the company might be willing to spend $1 million this time. GE had tried before, and others had tried before. $1 million this time to see if it finally couldn't be done. Now, two physicists were assigned to this problem, a man by the name of Strong and another one by the name of Bundy. They spent their first year of effort in searching the literature and trying to learn what others had done on this problem. Company management then decided they would like two chemists to also work on the problem. The physical chemists at the laboratory were called into a meeting. There were about 20 of them at that time. They were told we're going to work on a hush-hush secret project, and we'd like some volunteers. There was only one guy who volunteered, and I was the guy, so I got the job. In order to get a second chemist to work on this thing, they had to recruit one. They recruited a man by the name of Wintour, who had just obtained his PhD at the University of Wisconsin. Well, at one time or another then, during the next few years, these were the four men who worked on this diamond synthesis problem: Bundy, Strong, Wintour, and Hall. The work was divided into two areas. It was thought that the two physicists ought to try and improve Bridgman's equipment and get it to a point where it could be used to generate the pressure. And the two chemists ought to consider the thermodynamic problems, the rate problems, the catalysis problems, and the things that fit into that area. You may not want to start with graphite. Maybe you start with calcium carbonate or some other chemical compound that contains carbon. And such questions as this. Well, now, after a while, Bundy came up with a high-pressure device superior to anything that had been used before that he called the saucer apparatus. This was able to generate this kind of a pressure, which Joseph Rossini thought would make diamonds, and it was able to get this kind of a temperature. But as Bundy and Strong worked with this, with carbon and with other things, no diamonds were made. Well, Wintour and I also had the privilege of working with this device and trying some of our ideas, and no diamonds were made. Now, at this point in the history of things, scientists everywhere would have thought that if you could get this pressure and temperature, you could make the diamonds. Well, this meant a decision had to be made. It looked like the obvious thing to do would be to try and reach higher pressures and temperatures. And a modification of some of Bridgman's two-stage apparatus, and I don't have time to talk about that, was decided to be the thing to try and build. This required a gigantic press that you couldn't just buy off the shelf. It had to be specially constructed. It cost $100,000. Was of a double-acting 1,000-ton type. Take a couple of years to build. Well, a die was cast. Company management decided this was the direction to go. There was now going to be a waiting period in this program, and each of us on the program slowly went into other areas. Bundy working on bearings, I was working on some refrigeration problems, and so on. Well, I couldn't get my mind off this problem, and for some reason I was young enough and just impatient enough that I couldn't see waiting 2 years for this machine, and I started thinking about ways to generate high pressure that wouldn't require waiting for this machine. I had an idea that I took to the boss, and he allowed me to build it. Since this was in an area not my assignment, he asked Bundy to try it out with me. The apparatus had no name at this time, but later it came to have the name of a half belt. Well, for me, this apparatus could achieve a pressure about 20% higher than this in a much larger volume. Most of these high-pressure machines do not have a very large working volume. Well,
Bundy didn't think it was any good. I thought it was good. Bundy'd been there a lot longer than I was. He was my senior, and the boss listened to him instead of to me. I had an idea as to how to improve this particular device into a device which again didn't have a name, but later came to be known as the belt, just simply the belt. The company management would not provide funds for its construction because it was related to the first device that I had built, which they were not convinced was any good. Well, being fairly young at the time and ambitious and whatnot, I was kind of teed off, but I couldn't do anything about it. And I finally decided the only thing I could try to do would be to build it sub rosa somehow. And so I went to friends I had in the shop. I had no shop order for shop work because this was not my assignment. But I said, now look, Strong and Bundy aren't using their shop orders all the time, and maybe there's some other guys who aren't either. Now, why don't you just sneak this one in and build it whenever you have a little slack time? And they're friends of mine, so they did it. Now, it took 6 months this way to build it. It could have been built in a couple of weeks if I had a straightforward shop order to go ahead and build it then. Well, as I tested this thing out, I became thoroughly convinced that it could achieve pressures more than twice as high in still a larger volume and temperatures much higher than this. And I still could not convince my associate, nor my particular boss. Well, I'm running out of time here, but I had to do another thing. This was a hush-hush project. Not even our next-door neighbors in the lab were supposed to know about it. But I figured if my device wasn't any good, it wouldn't hurt to tell some other people about it. So I went to the boss that I first had when I went to work for the company back in 1948. Told him I had something I'd like to talk about at a seminar that he was conducting. So he invited me to do this. And I described this device to him and how it worked and what it would do, and he was converted. Now, he was on the same level as my own boss. So at the next meeting of the boss over these bosses, he told them they were missing a bet, that they ought to let Hall go ahead with this thing. Well, there were still more problems, but to make a long story short, eventually I went ahead with it. I was able to construct it out of tungsten carbide and whatnot. And this machine was able to achieve pressures that at the time we thought were 3 million pounds per square inch. No one had been there before. I had to decide what the pressure was myself, and I decided too high, but I guess you can forgive that kind of mistake. We now know today that it could achieve 2 million pounds per square inch. And there wasn't a scientist anywhere in the world. If he'd known you had such a machine, he would have said, you're in. You can make diamonds with a machine like that. It could achieve temperatures way beyond those required to melt steel. It could go up to 2,500 centigrade, no trouble at all. But the disappointing thing was, when you put graphite in this machine and subjected it to all the range of conditions available, it wouldn't turn to diamonds. And the company was just about ready to abandon the project because they hadn't intended to ever reach these kind of pressures. The press that was being built and purchased to amplify some of Bridgman's ideas wasn't expected to reach these pressures at all. By the way, this gadget only cost a couple thousand dollars. We're going to spend $1 million, remember. Well, we were all discouraged, but one day I got a thought. We were trying to figure out how diamonds were made down in South Africa. There's another place that diamonds come from, and that's in meteorites. There were at this time 3 known meteorites that had come to Earth that contained microscopic diamonds. And in reading about these diamonds and these meteorites, I learned that the diamonds were always found in nickel, iron, meteorites, and they were always surrounded by a mineral called troilite, which is primarily an iron sulfide. Well, one day I decided maybe the troilite could do the catalyst. And so I put some troilite in with the graphite and fortunately had the machine up to the right temperature and up to the right pressure. This was the 16th of December in 1954. At the end of the run, and I only let it run for 3 minutes, I broke open the tiny cell of this belt apparatus. And I was now familiar with diamonds. I had examined many natural diamonds. And there, through the light of the sun shining through the window, I caught the glint of some little tiny triangular facets on some octahedra. And my hand began to tremble, and my knees became weak, and my heart must have been 200 beats a minute. And I just knew that diamonds had finally been made. But of course, even having that kind of a feeling, that doesn't prove anything to a scientist. But I had to sit down for about 10 minutes before I could get my knees strong enough to walk up the stairs and look at these things under a microscope. Well, under a microscope, they looked every bit like a diamond, had all of the surface features that I had seen on many diamonds. I burned them in oxygen, as Lavoisier had done with natural diamonds many, many years before. Obtained carbon dioxide. They seemed to have about the density they ought to have and the optical properties. And then finally, in a few days, I was able to obtain an X-ray diffraction pattern, which is, of course, is just like a fingerprint. And the X-ray diffraction pattern said this stuff is diamond. Well, it took a while to convince my associates. It kind of came as a surprise. And after all, guys had been trying to do this for 150 years. And there had been many claims of success. But the trouble with the claims is that nobody had ever been able to duplicate them. I went on making diamonds for 20 days before any of my buddies even wanted to try the thing out to see if I was just kidding them or not. I made 27 different runs in those 20 days, changing variables here and there to try and catch on to what was going on and what pressure and temperature really were required. And I made diamonds in 12 out of the 27 runs. Well, finally, it kind of caught on that diamonds had been made, and the company decided then that the thing to do was to really verify this. We didn't want any fooling around. We wanted to know if this were really so. So the company attorneys came to Schenectady from New York. They had one of my associates, Wintour, and then they picked another man by the name of Oriani from the metallurgy department to come in and use this apparatus of mine and follow my directions and make diamonds. And they were to make 3 runs apiece. Well, what the dickens? Here was a brand new apparatus. I knew how to run it. It was difficult and a little bit complicated and fussy to run, and I couldn't be anywhere around. They weren't going to use the chemicals I was using. I might have soldered them, you know, and they had to get their own chemicals, and I had to instruct them, but then not be there when they did the work. Well, I kind of sweated about because I hadn't been successful in every run that I'd made. So they each made 3 runs, and it was with a sigh of relief that I heard that when they were through, had been examined by others, and they had made diamonds in all 6 runs. So at that point, everyone in the company was convinced. Now the next thing was, what should we do with this? Well, should we keep it a big secret and get it in commercial production, or should we tell the world? They decided to tell the world. And on the 15th of February, the company held what up to that time was their largest press release. They invited newspaper men, magazine men from around the world at company expense, and didn't tell them what to come to Schenectady for. They just said, come to Schenectady. We've got something great. We're paying all your way. We'll wine you and dine you after you get here and tell you all about it. Well, now, they had several plane loads of reporters and whatnot in New York City. They came into New York City and they put them on these special planes to fly them 180 miles up the Hudson River to Schenectady. Once they were on the planes, they passed out a brochure telling them that diamonds had been made. Now, the Albany Schenectady Airport back in 1954 was not a very big airport. and there was only one pay telephone. And I don't know which reporter managed to get off the plane first into that telephone to get the scoop for his newspaper. But however it was, it didn't do him any good anyway, because we later learned that the British Broadcasting Company at 6 a.m. that morning, our time, and the planes didn't arrive in Schenectady until 10 a.m. in the morning, had already announced that the General Electric Company claims that they have finally made diamonds. Well, I think that one can conclude from this that the spies of the British Broadcasting Company in the General Electric Company was kind of effective. No one knows how they got the information, but they announced it before it was released in America. Well, there are a couple of things about this synthesis that were valuable. Geologists have been telling us that it took perhaps hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years to grow the diamonds in South Africa, in these pipes, and perhaps it did. As we tried to make diamonds in the laboratory, this was one of the things that we were fearful of. We were afraid we might have to hold this chamber for months and months and months at pressure and tension in order to make diamonds. Well, this is okay if you knew exactly what to put in there and what pressure to use and what temperature to use. But where you're doing experiments, where you've got to vary all these quantities and learn how to make diamonds, if you spend several months doing one experiment, this really slows you down. Now, most of the experiments I had been conducting, I had just run for 2 or 3 minutes. Actually, this experiment was up to temperature for only 2 minutes, yet it had grown diamonds, and it had grown them in quantity. I mentioned that the diamonds among the pebbles were only 1 in 60 million. It's not much better in the pipe mines. They take out about 60 million parts of the yellow ground to one part of diamond. Well, in our little tiny capsules, and by the way, my chamber was only about, it was not quite 1 inch long and about 1/8 of an inch in diameter. And if I only could make diamond one part in 60 million, I couldn't find it with any microscope that we had around the GE company, even if it knew what part of the sample looked what. But the diamonds had been grown in 2 minutes, and they were there in quantity. It was a good yield. So just like that, GE had a commercial process. They took the thing and put it in a pilot plant in Detroit. This was about the beginning of 1955 that the diamonds had been made and had been decided that they'd really been made. By the fall of 57, General Electric Company had synthetic diamonds on the market. I should have passed these out earlier because we won't have time to get it out. Here are synthetic diamonds of the kind that are made in the General Electric plant. GE has captured about 1/2 of the diamond market, natural and synthetic put together, for use in grinding wheels. They make about $13 million worth of these every year. When I first made diamonds, the price per carat was about $3. The price is now down to about $2.65. General Electric would put the price 5 cents under the De Beers Syndicate price, the natural diamond people, and they'd come down a nickel. But by the time it got to $2.65, it leveled off, and you could buy either natural or the man-made for the same price. Well, now this kind of ended a period. Men had been trying for 150 years to make the diamonds. They were finally made. It had exceeded General Electric's fondest hopes. Total expenses to this point had been $300,000, not the $1 million they had said they were willing to put in, and they had a new commercial product. Now, a new era opened at this point. The new era was the use of high pressure in scientific experiments. I think that those of you who are somewhat deeply involved in science, particularly chemistry, if you've had a chance to get into thermodynamics, will know that there are certain very important variables. Pressure, temperature, volume, composition, and specific heat. Let's say specific heat at constant volume.
If one knows all of these things, you know all there is to know about a system from a thermodynamic standpoint. Temperature has been used as a variable in studying materials and making new materials and in doing all kinds of thermodynamics and chemical experiments. Composition, what to put together, sulfur and hydrogen, chlorine and fluorine, or whatever you put together, has been the other important variable. These two together have been used for ages by man, for ceramics, glasses, metals, and other chemical substances. Pressure has been used, but primarily only in the realm of gaseous substances. But now, we had pressures that could compare in the energy that they could inject into systems that man had been putting into systems very easily with bonfires or nowadays with a Bunsen burner in the laboratory. Only trouble, you can buy a Bunsen burner for about 2.5. For a large machine, to work on a large scale like you can work on with temperature, you're talking at least $100,000 if you want to put 100,000 atmospheres of pressure in the thing. But pressure has now come into its own as a variable for dealing with solid and liquid substances. 10 years ago, the number of people who were doing work at high pressures and high temperatures could be counted on your hand. Today, there are 1,000 workers and 250 laboratories around the world. So this is an area, then, that has come into its own. It's being used to do a lot of things in science. Pressures affect melting points. You can send melting points up or down by hundreds and hundreds of degrees by varying the pressure. You can change the electrical resistance of substances. You can produce new polymers similar to the diamond that I have described. Almost any experiment that has been conducted by a physicist in the past using these other variables, whether it be nuclear magnetic resonance, some X-ray type of experiment, a neutron diffraction experiment, or whatnot, someone is now working to add the additional variable of pressure. Now, the additional variable of pressure gives you an increased handle on not only producing new substances, but also in understanding what happens in new substances. So although diamond was the goal, the goal at the General Electric Company, the successful synthesis of that material opened up a brand new scientific area of investigation. Now this talk has taken a somewhat different turn than I intended in the beginning, and I've got about 30 slides over there that would probably amount to another 1 hour talk, so I guess I hadn't better show them to you. But just for the fun of it, why don't you show me about the first three slides so I can show them what some of this kind of apparatus looks like. Oh, I want the large slides. I have another story that I'd sure like to tell you, but I don't have the time. Let me give it to you in just a few sentences. The Bell apparatus that I invented at the General Electric Company was regarded in a very secretive manner by the company, and later even had a government secrecy put on it. I left General Electric in 1955 to go to a university where I could exploit some of the many things that I saw in geology, chemistry, physics, and most any science, and fully intended to use this invention of mine, the Bell apparatus, in this work. But when I left the company, their chief patent attorney took me aside and told me I couldn't use it outside of the company limits. Well, I tried to make arrangements so I could use it, but they were all unsatisfactory. I talked to government people and could not make any arrangements whereby I could use it. And one day a man in the Department of Commerce says, "Hall, invent another device." Well, I didn't really want to do that, but as I thought about it, I decided that was the only way out if I was going to continue working in this field. in which I kind of felt like it was my baby and I was the daddy of it. Well, to make a long story short, I did invent another apparatus. It's known as the tetrahedral anvil press. And here is one that is completely equipped with X-ray diffraction gear, so that we can have a sample in the center of this tetrahedral press, under a high pressure and under a temperature, and look in with a beam of X-rays, obtain a powder diffraction pattern, and work backwards to tell what has happened to the crystal structure as we apply these high pressures and high temperatures. We have 6 of these kind of machines at Brigham Young and about a dozen professors and 20 graduate students working in the field. These are used around the world. This was disclosed, of course, before the GE device is made available to the public. An interesting thing, they have these in Russia, they use them there. The Russians give me credit for inventing this, but they don't give me credit for inventing the belt apparatus. They claim they invented it at the same time. A man by the name of Farashogin is in charge of almost all of the high-pressure work in Russia. And he said, I heard him with my own ears in a meeting, he says, this idea was just in the air. He says, it's true, Hall invented it, but we invented it too. Well, I have appreciated the opportunity of speaking with you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. And if any of these questions pertain to any of the slides that I haven't shown you, maybe we can take time to show one or two of them. Thank you very much. I thought at the time that I did it that it was 95,000 atmospheres and 1,700 degrees centigrade. We now know that it was about 70,000 atmospheres. The temperature was approximately correct. Now, the iron sulfide, or the troilite mineral, it turned out as I continued to make tests that the mineral itself was not needed. It was the iron that was doing the job. Troilite tends to be a mineral that is non-stoichiometric. It contains more iron. Does sulfur correspond to the theoretical composition? Well, knowing that iron would do the job and knowing that it came from iron nickel meteorites, you would suspect that nickel may also do the job. Nickel was tried and worked. As a matter of fact, almost any transition element will serve as a catalyst and solvent. We think it performs both roles for transforming graphite to diamond. You have to somehow break up the graphite lattice. These sheets of hexagonal rings have to be broken up. This means you've got to have a solvent. But in addition, it seems that nickel and other transition metals get a loose hold on the carbon atom and make it put out a couple of bonds in tetrahedral fashion. So we think that these metals, they're molten, we take them just to their melting point, act as a solvent, but also as a catalyst. And the reason we think that is that you can dissolve carbon in lead under these high pressures and high temperatures. You can also dissolve the carbon in SiO2. As a matter of fact, you can dissolve it in almost any mineral, any silicate mineral, under these pressure-tensure conditions. But no one has been able to make the darn stuff come out as diamond. It always comes out, precipitates out as graphite. So there must be a catalytic effect connected with these transition metal elements in addition to the solvent effect. Question? Prerequisite to making gem diamonds, but it's the first one. You have to have bigger equipment than anyone has right now so that you can more accurately control the temperature and the gradients and have a volume over which you have greater control. I'm sure that the gem diamonds will come. I think 5 years ago I said, well, somebody will make diamonds 5 years from now of gem quality, but it hasn't come yet. It certainly will come sometime in the not too distant future. Question? In the Belt apparatus, and I didn't describe that or give you pictures of it, it's this tungsten carbide, the stuff I passed around. Tungsten carbide is the strongest engineering material that we have today that will stand a high compressive strain. So you try to design an apparatus in which the loading is only compressive and in which you get support from massive members of the tungsten carbide or from surrounding steel supports. The Belt apparatus had this kind of a thing, and the tetrahedral press also has this kind of a thing. Any of these devices, the TET press or the Belt device, would go to higher pressures if we had something that was stronger in its compressive strength than the tungsten carbide. Steel wouldn't do it. There are geometrical arrangements in these devices, and I'm afraid it would be another talk if I went into the details of how they actually work. Question? The diamond reaction has been tried, of course, at room temperature. I'm not aware of anyone trying it at low temperature. You wouldn't think low temperature would be appropriate in this case because graphite has covalent bonds. They're strong bonds in graphite. They've got to be broken up. And this almost invariably means you've got to put temperature in there. And then, of course, the diamond itself forms strong covalent bonds. And the activation energy for formation of these bonds and the strength of the bonds are about as high as anything that we know of in chemistry. And so you would almost a priori say you've got to have high temperature to loosen the atoms up in order to make diamonds. Thank you again.